Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans. We're here in Bristol on BCFM every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week we hear from Rachel Brodie. She's from the National Union of Journalists branch in Manchester and has just been producing something called The Guide to Reporting Poverty, an antidote to the Daily Mail style divide and rule, trying to get the readers to hate poor people rather than the rich that are messing the world up. Also, the first of several parts of a longer interview with the Grassy Knoll shooter of John F. Kennedy. Well, you may not believe it. Well, it's totally up to you. You have a listen to him and decide. He's the assassin or hitman for the Chicago Mafia, and his name's James Files. He was working alongside, he says, another Chicago hitman from the Mafia, Charles Nicoletti, who was in the Daltech building. Finally today, it's Bilderberg. I've just come back from the Bilderberg conference. This is a organisation that was set up in 1954, secret meetings of European royalty, politicians, media owners and editors, internet titans like Google, LinkedIn, Amazon, etc. Also the secret services and royalty, yes, royalty. So we're going to hear from a guy called Rich Nyland, who I met there. He thinks that there's going to be some kind of catastrophe. Difficult to actually pin him down on what it's going to be, but he says either a financial collapse or possibly biological weapons, and he explains why. But first, Rachel Brodie from the National Union of Journalists in Manchester and her guide to reporting poverty.
I'm Rachel Brodie. I'm the equality officer for Manchester and Salford branch of the National Union of Journalists.
And what is this initiative about?
This is really recognising that in certain areas of the media, there is a concerted persecution of poor people. There's language used that undermines poor people. I have many front pages of the likes of the Daily Mail, the Daily Star. For example, Vile Products of Welfare UK was one of the ugliest. That story was about children who, it was a tragedy, children who were killed in a house fire. The Chancellor actually came out after that and said lifestyles like that were being funded by welfare. His suggestion being the people who murdered those children did so because they were living in Welfare UK. It was a very provocative, thoroughly unattractive way to approach what was described by the police at the time as a tragedy.
What are you suggesting to journalists around the country?
Well, we've created guidelines. There are six simple guidelines. The strongest one is possibly that we need, as trade unionists, to take responsibility for what it is that we produce and how we're contributing to how certain sections of society are treated.
Yeah, but for a lot of journalists, actually, their eye is on their pay packet and they don't want to upset the editor or the manager.
Yeah, and I can see that. And this is why we want to get this into as many workplaces as possible to start having the conversation. And what is important about the reporting pack, the guide for journalists, is that it's not written by journalists. It's not one set of journalists telling another set of journalists what to do. It's real people whose lives have been impacted by what they've read in the newspapers, trying to engage with journalists to get them to reconsider what it is that they're writing and also to go out and learn about what it is that they're writing. If they've not experienced poverty, then they need to stop and consider what it is to exist in poverty rather than just react to misinformation or, you know, it's asking people to research and to engage.
Yeah, I mean, isn't this partly because journalism has changed over the last 50 years where people don't kind of go knocking on doors to get stories anymore? They're sitting on a laptop and much of their reporting is done remotely.
Well, it might be, but it's not an excuse not to do thorough research. And it's not an excuse to engage with derogatory language towards one section of the community.
Okay, so what are these points that you're making, your 6 points?
We're asking trade unionists and journalists to stop and consider how stereotypes are contributing to the demonisation of working poor and benefit recipients.
This is like things like scroungers, this kind of benefit scroungers.
Scroungers, skivers, jobless mum. I saw one the other day about it was an obese skiver. You know, there are various ways in which it's becoming repetitive and relentless in the language that's used. And also, this isn't just about print media, it's also about broadcast media. So looking at programmes like Dogs on the Dole and asking why are these things becoming used so repetitively. And because they're being used, it is giving the likes of the Chancellor and the former DWP Minister, Department for Welfare and Pensions Minister, the opportunity to keep referring to people as having these lifestyles. People who are living in poverty being described as a lifestyle. And one of the things I say is that people are concerned that we're returning to the days of the deserving and the undeserving poor. I argue we're actually just returning to the days of the undeserving poor. Anybody who is poor, be they on benefits or in a low income, now faces this diatribe from sections of the media that stereotypes them and undermines them and ultimately demonises them. One of the things that we asked the National Union of Journalists to do is to monitor the development of coverage in this area and to give support to those members who do decide that they want to enforce our aims and who do decide that they want to tell their bosses, I don't want to write that.
It's almost as if you're implying that there is a deliberate attempt to put this information out to deceive people.
I think there is a deliberate attempt to put things out there to deceive people. I think the right-wing media uses this intentionally to create division, to create these stereotypes. And this is why we have a Tory government that's able to use this information to support its own policies in welfare reform.
So these guidelines you've drawn up for reporting poverty, do you think the journalists in the national press in London will listen?
I think it's going to be difficult to get the journalists in the national press in London to listen. I think also we do have to understand that they are workers and that there are limitations in what they can do. But as a union, we would want to support them in defying what it is they're being asked to write. But more significantly, we want them to research and we want them to look at our guide to reporting poverty and listen to the voices of people who are living in poverty, people who are experiencing it, and can educate them as to what it actually is like.
Do you think, actually, it's also quite useful for journalists to be able to say to their boss, well, actually, the reason I want to write it like that is because of this, rather than just to, because some, I imagine some journalists are kind of isolated by their bosses, and this is something where they can say, well, actually, this is a basic standard here. Are you going to really argue with that?
I'd like to think that they could go back to the boss and say, this is the experience of real people. This has been researched. We've discussed this with people. We're looking at the genuine statistics here, and we want to use them accurately and fairly and appropriately. The guidelines are currently available on the Church Action on Poverty website because we're actually working in partnership with Church Action on Poverty. And they will also be available on the NUJ's various online spaces. At the minute, it's about getting them out there and getting the discussion started, and then we'll see what we can do.
That was Rachel Brodie from the National Union of Journalists Manchester branch, who's just brought out something called the Guide to Reporting Poverty.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
On the grassy knoll of the JFK assassination in 1963 was a man called James Files. At least that's his confession. And he confessed to a guy called Wim Dankbar, who's a Dutch reporter. And there are all sorts of threats that this is going to be broadcast, this interview. But anyway, let's have a listen to it, because I found it just sitting there on YouTube. He was working for the Chicago Mafia alongside a guy called Charles Nicoletti. And you can look all this up. And they were being run by the CIA, which explains partly why there was no proper investigation into JFK's assassination. And their handler was a guy called David Attlee Phillips, who'd been involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion. Charles Nicoletti was behind Kennedy's car in the Daltech building, and James Files says he was there on the grassy knoll with his Remington Fireball. He's a sharpshooter from the 82nd Airborne Division. So let's hear the first part of that interview now.
When Joe West first originally contacted me here at Stateville Prison, I was on a visit. The counselor came in the visiting room where I was at and stated that she wanted me to come out and make a phone call. I told her, I said, no way. I'm here 365 days a year. I'm not leaving my visit to go make a phone call. I said, who's calling? She told me, someone from Texas named Joe West. I told him, I do not know the party. I said, tell them I'll call them on my time, not their time. I'm on a visit. Don't bother me when I'm on a visit. The next day, they come, got me out of my cell. They took me downstairs and got a phone call hooked up. I called Joe West to talk to him. I told him, you have 3 minutes to convince me why I should talk to you. As Joe started talking to me, I told him, I said, whoa, stop. I said, you're on a lot of touchy spots. I said, these phone calls are recorded. Every phone call going in and coming out is recorded. If you want to talk to me that bad, then I suggest you come and visit me. Joe West had me put him on his visiting list. He come up to visit me. He spent 2 days up here talking with me. The first day, I wouldn't even talk to him about the Kennedy situation. We got into sports, weather, generally about prison, local things, till I got comfortable with him. The next day, after I thought it over all night, Joe S. seemed like a pretty nice guy. I really liked Joe. He had a magnetism about him. The next day, we sat down, we got serious, and then we started talking. I sit in the dining or in the visiting room with Joe. They gave us a pencil and paper. I sketched the entire Lilly Plaza out for him without any maps, without any pictures, nothing present. And I explained to Joe at that time, because Joe wanted to know where was I at. And I said, I'm going to put an X on the paper to signify me, but this X is not in the correct spot. I said, when the time comes, then I will put the X where it is supposed to be.
What had you told him to know that that you were on the plot?
Pardon me?
What had you told him that Joe knew you were on the plot?
Oh, I asked him. He said that someone had informed him that I was there. He said he had a reliable source. And I didn't know for quite a while who that source was. It was quite some time later before I learned the fact that the FBI was aware of my presence as early as 1964. Because I never knew that anyone ever knew about me. But Zach Sheldon, from what I understand, and I'm only quoting this from hearsay, that Zach was the one that stated and gave me to Joe West the information on me, that I was in Dealey Plaza.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever actually confess to taking a shot to Joe West?
No, I never did.
I'd make a statement.
I never. Well, the whole thing is, like with Joe West, Joe West died. He passed away, never knowing that I was one of two shooters there in Dealey Plaza that day. Joe West never knew I was on the grassy knoll.
Do you have any thoughts on his death? Do you think that was natural?
Joe West went in for heart surgery, and from what I was told and what I understood, that he had come through it fairly well, and he was on the road to recovery. But then I was informed there was complications with his medicine. He was allergic to it, or an allergy or something. He saw that they killed him, the medication killed him. A couple of years ago, maybe a year and a half ago, I heard through the grapevine, and I won't go into the party that brought this information to me, they said that someone had tampered with Joe's medication and he had received the wrong medication because they wanted to silence him.
That's what his wife.
Yeah.
Thinks. Okay.
And why would they want to silence him?
We had Joe West had the case in court. He wanted to exhume John F. Kennedy's body. And that's what he was fighting for. And at this point, when I talked to Joe West, I explained to him that John F. Kennedy had been hit in the head with a mercury round, a special load. At this point, I explained to him he can use this in the courts to have the body exhumed because there would still be traces of mercury because the traces of mercury do not disappear. It'll always be there. And so this is what Joe West wanted, to go back with more evidence and use this to get Kennedy's body exhumed, to look for traces of mercury.
And the court had accepted his case.
The court had accepted his case. But with his death, the case died. The first time that I knew about anything being planned on Kennedy, well, I'd heard a lot of rumors that nobody liked Kennedy. They wanted to kill Kennedy. They wanted to assassinate him. They wanted to do everything to the man.
Were you kind of upset with him yourself over Bay of
Pigs? I was upset with him over the Bay of Pigs, but I never paid any attention to any of this at first because, you know, everybody talks. Somebody gets mad at somebody right away, and I'm going to take this guy out. I'm going to take that person out. Woo, 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 woo. You know, a lot of barking, junkyard dogs barking, you know. But I was sitting in the Harlow Grill that evening playing the pinball machine, not the flipper kind, the kind with numbers where you gamble on and you put about $10 in to play a game. And Charles Nicoletti walked in, a man that I did a lot of work with, a man that I respected. And he walked in the back room where I was at. He says, "Jimmy, let's go." I said, "I'll be with you in a minute." He reached over and told the machine and said, "Let's go now." My reply was, "Yes, sir, Mr. Nicoletti." I knew he wasn't in no mood to wait and hang around. He said, "I want to talk to you." I went out, I got in this car, and we went for a ride. And we made it a basic habit not to sit around restaurants, talk, reels, discuss anything like that, because we wanted other people hearing. And we went for a ride, and he told me, he says, "We're going to do a friend of yours." And I said, "Jesus, what the hell did he do now?" But I thought this was referring to one of my friends in town there. He had been robbing the pinball machines and the cigarette machines, and he had a $1,000 a day heroin habit. And he was an all out and out junkie, and you know, they'd beat him up several times and everything else and threatened him, but so far they'd never went as far as to kill him. Chuck laughed at me and he says, "No," he says, "not him." He says, "I'm talking about President Kennedy, JFK. And I looked at him and I said, "What?" He says, "JFK." He says, "Your buddy." I said, "Well, he just busting, you know, giving me a hard time, but he knew JFK, he knew how much I disliked the man." And I looked at him and I laughed. I said, "Okay, fine, fine with me. You getting arguments there?" And at this point, I still kind of thought, you know, he was just joking with me. But then he got real serious about it. And so then we started talking, and then he told me, he says, "What I'm going to want you to do," he says, "I'm going to look around." He says, "We'll search the area around the town here." He says, "You know everything pretty good," he says, "and see what before we're going to do it at, what kind of weapons we're going to need, and other things like that," he says. And he mentioned, he said, he was going to bring Johnny Roselli in on it. Fine with me, you know, I don't care who we work with. You know, I like Johnny. I had no problems with him. And originally we'd planned to do it in the Chicago area, but certain people didn't like that idea. So then we put it off, and this is like 6 months before the assassination ever really took place.
But you were not supposed to be a shooter?
Oh, no, never. I was not a shooter. I was, let's put it this way. I would like, you know, the gopher. I go for this, go for that, pick this up, pick that up, run around, drive him around. When Chuck went somewhere, I was always with him. And
did you ever get wind that the Secret Service might have found out about the plot in Chicago?
No, I didn't get no wind on that at all, no drip. I just knew that certain people high up in organized crime, they wasn't too happy about the idea of having something like that happen to that magnitude in their backyard.
Gotcha.
Because they figured Bobby would really be down there, you know, and they already had their own little private wars going. And so we decided, well, we'd take a move. So I had no idea it was going to Texas at that point. This come to me down the road.
About when was that?
Well, I think, I'm going to say probably, oh, 2.5, 3 months maybe before I ever made the trip to Texas that they were talking about it. Because they didn't know where he was going to go. They were looking for an area to go. But then they had heard that he possibly may take this trip to Texas, but there was nothing definite. And I didn't go to Texas until that had been confirmed. And they had several different locations. There was New Orleans, and I don't know, there's other places he was going to. But when it come down to it, I had been told there was places that they had planned to do it. Other people had been authorized, you know, and stuff like that. Just different rumors you hear. How much credibility is to it, I cannot say. But when the time come, and we knew that it was going to be serious, and we were going to, Chuck was sending me to Texas. That's when I went down on Bellman Avenue, the old Valley place where we made they made the pinball machines. And I had a shed down there, a place where we, back room. That was all owned by the outfit, too, pinball machines. I kept a catch of weapons down there. We used to do a lot of work. And when I say we, I'm referring to a party named Wolfman, who is now deceased. But at that time, he was excellent remodifying weapons, manufacturing loads, whatever come down to handguns, rifles. This guy was a professional at it. He could manufacture things in his basement like you wouldn't believe, from silencers on down the line. He did it all for him. So I went down there, got the stuff we needed, and we had the one car that he just bought, already had everything secured in. We had secret compartments in it. And every car that we had, even before the 63 Chevy, even in the 61 Ford that we had prior to that, in the 62, we had compartments in the dash where you could reach up under it, open things up, put grenades in there, handguns, whatever we might need, behind the back seat. We had gun racks in the cars. We had pull-off door panels that would snap off. You could put them back on. We had handguns and stuff in there, whatever you might need. But we always had a work car ready.
So what did Wolfman do for you?
Wolfman, when I contacted him after all this went down, and this is several years later, this is when I first met Joe West, and Joe West had come here, visited me, we talked, And he asked me, he said, do you think this party called Wolfman would talk to me? And Joe asked me what his real name was, and I told him, I said, I won't divulge that, but I will call him and talk to him. So I called him on the phone, and I told him, I said, I'm talking to Joe West from Texas, and he wanted to know who Joe was, and I explained all this to him, and I said, Joe would very much like to interview. I said, I did not give Joe West your name, but I told him that you was the one that manufactured the special round. You made 6 rounds for me to take to Texas, all mercury loaded. I said, he wants to talk to you very much. Will you talk with him? And he said, get back to him. He said, I'll let you know. He said, I want to check a few things. The following week, Wolfman was dead.
How'd he die?
I believe he had a heart attack. I've been in contact with nobody that was affiliated with Wolfman since that day.
Tell me about these mercury loads. Can you describe them for just a layperson?
Well, it was a 22 round, and he took the tips out. He drilled them out. Then he inserted, with an eyedropper, he put mercury into the end of the round, and he resealed them with wax. This is to make them explode on impact.
Okay. So now you've got, and let's describe the car.
The car was a 63 Chevy Tudor Burgundy, Chevy Impala.
With the special compartments.
Oh, we had special, yeah, we had the special compartment, the dash. We had the back seat, you could take that off, pull the bottom part out, then you raise the back up, snap it off, the little clamps, take that out. We had the springs removed in the behind the seat there by it, and we had little racks welded in there so we could mount weapons in there.
Okay, so now you got your weapons, you got your loads, you got your car. How did it come together after that?
Well, just before I left, final instructions was Chuck told me, he said, I want you to leave first thing in the morning. He says, and I don't want you driving at night. He said, I want you on the highway with a lot of traffic during daytime where nobody pays any attention to you.
Let's go back. Give me a date or approximate date.
I don't remember the approximate date, but I went down like a week before the assassination. Okay. I want to say I was in Dallas area 5 days before the assassination took place.
And what was the purpose of that?
The purpose of that was for me to go to Dallas, look over the area, learn dead-end streets, railroad crossings, time for train crossings. They already knew the regular motorcade route that he would be taking, and they had already looked that over, and they wanted to see if there's any better places, and a lot of people had already decided on. I'm not the one that chose Dealey Plaza, but I was told to look it over very close and look and see if I thought there's any other place better. And I did the whole area from the route they had. All the way through, I had Lee Harvey Oswald with me.
All right, go back now. So about a week ahead of time, I think it was a Monday, as I recall.
Something, I'm not sure.
Okay, yeah. But you left Chicago. Just start. You left Chicago, you went to?
No, I didn't leave on a Monday. I left either Thursday morning or Friday. I don't remember which. I know I was in Mesquite, Texas, Saturday morning. Okay. But that's when Lee Harvey Oswald showed up at the motel where I was at. I arrived there on a Friday. I'm pretty sure it was Friday when I arrived there.
Did you call anybody when you got to Dallas?
I made 2 telephone calls when I got there. I called Charles Nicoletti, told him that I was on the scene, and where I was at, in case he had to reach me. I turned around and made another phone call. I called David Atlee Phillips. I had a number to call. The call was put through to David Phillips, and he was notified where I was at, because I had not told him in advance that I was going to Dallas, Texas.
And why did you call David Atlee Phillips?
Because he always had to know where I was at, because he was my controller.
For?
CIA purposes, special operations, or something that might be needed done.
And you were supposed to stay in contact with him?
We always stayed in contact. We had numbers to call.
What happened after that?
He said, thank you, and let it go at that. We didn't have any great discussion on the phone. I told him where I was at, the location, and through David Atlee Phillips is the only way that Lee Harvey Oswald could have known where I was at. But I had called no one else. I made 2 phone calls.
Where were you staying?
I was staying at the Lamplighter Inn right there in Mesquite, Texas.
And then the next thing you knew, Lee Harvey Oswald.
The following morning, Lee Harvey Oswald was there. When he knocked on the door, I opened the door and I was shocked to see him, because I didn't think anybody knew where I was at except for the other 2 people.
Why is Phillips the only one who could have sent Lee Harvey Oswald?
Because Charles Nicoletti had never met Lee Harvey Oswald.
He didn't know him.
He did not know him.
You say you were shocked to see him, but did you know Lee Harvey Oswald?
I had known Lee Harvey Oswald prior to that, yes.
How'd you know him?
I knew him from earlier operation that we was on with David Phillips when I was running semi-automatic 45 caliber submachine guns down to Clinton, Louisiana. They were made, I think they were manufactured by Knoxville Arms. They were not the old Thompson. They looked like a Thompson submachine gun, but they were not Thompson. They were only semi-automatic. And they were very cheaply made.
And how do you meet? Did you meet Lee Harvey Oswald?
I met Lee Harvey Oswald through David Adlai Phillips. When I got down there, he introduced me to Lee.
Was it your understanding that Phillips was also Oswald's CIA contact?
I learned that when I was down there. That is the first time he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald, and he also instructed me that Lee could be trusted and that he was Lee's controller.
He made that as a statement.
He made it as a statement because I wanted to know who he was dealing with and who I was giving weapons to.
I need you to make a statement that I was introduced by Phillips, and who was my CIA handler, and I was told that he was Oswald.
We didn't call them handlers back then. We called them controllers.
Okay.
David Adlai Phillips, he introduced me to Lee Harvey Oswald. And upon doing this, he also explained to me that he was Lee Harvey Oswald's controller, the same as he was mine. That he was always in contact with Lee Harvey Oswald.
So that's how you know that's where the word came for Oswald to come meet you in Dallas.
So that, through common sense, tells me the only one that could have sent Lee Harvey Oswald to me was David Adlai Phillips. And when I opened the door and Oswald was there, I was kind of shocked to see him because I didn't know that he knew I was there. And so I asked Lee, I says, what the hell are you doing here? Because I was shocked, you know. He said, I was advised to drop by and spend some time with you and see if I could help you out. I said, help me out? He said, yes. He says, somebody wants me to show you the area. And I said, okay. He said, come on in. So he coming in. So we sit down and we talked. And I said, I'll be with you in a few minutes. And I was young and cocky at that time. And I'd just come out of the shower and everything. And I was combing my hair. So I had a camera there. So I told Lee, he said, hey, make a couple of pictures while I'm here in Texas. And so Oswald made a couple of pictures of me. And then he said, let me have the film. I get it developed. I said, no. I said, I get the whole roll of film. So that was how I got a couple of pictures made that people have recently asked me about.
Whose camera was it? Yours or
my
yours?
Camera.
Your camera.
Yeah, but he was going to take the film, turn him in, get him developed. But I said no.
Then we'll let that film go.
I do my own work.
How did he arrive at the motel?
He arrived driving a blue Falcon, Ford Falcon.
You remember what year model?
No, I don't. It wasn't a brand. It was a couple of years old.
So he could drive?
Yes, he could drive. When he met me in Clinton, Louisiana, he drove up in a, I want to say Chevrolet truck. It could have been a Ford. I'm going to say pickup. It was a pickup truck. Let me put it that way. It was an old pickup truck. And we put the weapons in the back end of it and pulled the tarp down over the weapons.
What color? Do you remember what color pickup?
I believe it was green. It was a real, I don't know, dirty, yucky green, whatever you want to call it, darker green like, you know. It hadn't been washed in a long time, and there's a lot of rust on it. That's about the best way to describe it.
So did you and Lee Oswald drive around Dallas then?
We drove around Dallas. Lee Harvey Oswald and I, we drove around Dallas for about the up till right before the assassination. I did not see Lee Harvey Oswald on the morning of the assassination. But prior to that, Lee Harvey Oswald had been with me every day. We drove around. He showed me different streets, different areas. He was the one that took me out to the place southeast of Mesquite there, next to a big junkyard. We went out there in the field. He said, ain't nobody going to bother you out here, you know, because I wanted to calibrate the scopes for not only for the fireball, but for other weapons as well. And while I was out there firing weapons and ejecting shell casings, Lee was picking them up and holding them in his hand. But I didn't want to leave no casings or nothing behind, and I'm busy firing, so I just looked at Lee, grab them casings. And that's what he did. He picked them and he held on to them until we got released. I calibrated my scope, set things up, put the stuff back in the car, and we got back in. We went riding around, and I wanted to know the railroad crossings. I wanted to wait and see what time trains come through. I want to know if there's any passengers, if there was freight trains. They stopped. The track's going to be blocked. The intersection's going to be blocked. Dead-end streets, construction work, wherever the intersection was at. Where all the lights were at, how long the lights were, they stayed red. I wanted all these little details.
Did anybody show up or give you any static while you were out there sighting in those weapons?
No, nobody. When I was test firing the weapons, nobody at all even come out there, looked at me. And there wasn't any housing, nobody real close by. We're off the main highway there. And like I say, it was just, you know, nobody come around, nobody even cared.
No, I remember back then we'd go out on Turtle Creek and shoot turtles, and nobody, cops, yeah. showed up.
How much time were you two together during the day?
We was out there test firing. We were test firing weapons for approximately, 20, 30 minutes. But during the day, we probably worked 5 hours, 6 hours together.
So all that time, he could not have been working in the Texas Book Depository?
No. He worked in the book depository stores, what he told me. I was never in that place. But he had time off to come out and spend time with me, and then I would drop him off in the area, and he would go somewhere, and I guess that's where he went. I had never asked him where he went, what he'd done, who he saw.
That was Grassy Knoll assassin James Files, part of the Chicago Mafia. He was on the Grassy Knoll, he says, and he says Charles Nicoletti was his co-assassin, co-hitman, who was in the Daltech building behind Kennedy's motorcade. They were being run by the CIA, a guy called David Attlee Phillips, which is why he knew that he would never be prosecuted for it. And the only reason he's speaking out now, Files, is because he says, no one's ever going to prosecute me for assassinating JFK. And more from him next week and in future weeks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, I've just come back from the Bilderberg Conference, and over there I spoke to a guy called Rich Nyland. He's an American living in Germany. Just to explain what Bilderberg is, these secret meetings started in 1954, 10 years after World War II, at the site of a battle in 10 years previously in 1944, that is the Battle of Arnhem, portrayed in the film A Bridge Too Far. And the first Bilderberg meeting took place in Oosterbeek, where the British airborne forces were massacred in that battle. It consists of media barons, bosses, politicians, internet titans, the secret services, finance ministers. Basically, they control most of the money in the Western world. So let's see what Rich Nyland makes of the Bilderbergs.
My name's Rich Nyland. I come each year to the Bilderberg to inform myself and to also show a form of opposition to this corrupt organization that meets here privately and secretly, but at the taxpayers' expense. Now, I would appreciate if we could find out what they're actually talking about and what decisions they're making. They claim they don't make any decisions, but I think history shows that a lot of decisions are made at these meetings. And unfortunately, the public is rarely informed about what actually goes on here. Most of the people that you see here have no idea what's going on. We even have the police here, the special police with their little blue tops that are supposedly to inform the citizens about what's actually going on here. I had a nice long conversation this morning, and it was really a whitewash.
What did the police tell you was happening then?
Yeah, they said it was a Bilderberg meeting, and you know, I questioned whether they thought that this was actually a good thing or a bad thing, and the police thought it was a real good thing. And I was shocked. And I questioned them numerous times, saying, you know, do you really know what's going on here? And they said, this is a form of a democracy, is what the police told me. I said, what kind of a democracy? This is a secret meeting.
Well, just as an aside, I was discussing it with the police the first night we were here. Yeah. And he said, so you mean there's no point in voting?
Yeah, and this morning what the police said to me was that, well, you have your opportunity. You can vote the people out the next time if you don't like what they're doing. And, you know, I personally don't believe that we really have a democracy. I think the main goal of what they want is they want to set up what they call a one-world government, but really it's a one-world dictatorship. They want to consolidate all the power into their hands, a small group elite, and basically the rest of the world will be enslaved. And that's the same thing that we've had this struggle now for hundreds of years, which is really freedom or tyranny. And that's what's at stake here. Our freedom is slowly being eroded by this group, and that's their goal. They want to take away all of our freedoms.
Now, I know you think that there's been a lot of financial manipulation since around about 2000. Can you tell us how, you know, what you make of that?
Well, I think up until the year 2000, what we had is an economy which was expanding, and it was purposely done that way, where we were all working to build up a large nest egg, which they knew long in advance they were going to harvest and take away from us. And that's basically what's happened since the year 2000. Now the economy's going down because they're slowly taking the cream off of the top. And, you know, in 2008, there was a large, you know, harvesting right there in one chunk. And probably we're going to see something like that again, where clearly it's, you know, the chance for our future, you know, financially is not really good.
No, this debt is building up. But basically, we've got a similar sort of situation that was happening in the run-up to 2008. But I wonder how you think that that people like the Bilderbergs, I mean, the Kissingers, the bankers, the top financial people in the Western world, how they intend to do things in the future. I mean, we know there may be a financial crisis, but that's not the only type of crisis.
Yeah, well, the way I see it is that they want to install a world government, and they want to get rid of the sovereignty of all the countries in the world. Now, if you were to go to the citizenship today and ask them, oh, you know, let's, you know, put in a world government, we'll get rid of all the different countries, the people would definitely not vote for that. So in order to achieve that goal, they know they need to create a crisis, a large crisis, something the equivalent of a world war or so, where the people at the end are all down on their knees and begging. And only at that point would the people be willing to accept something like a world government and to get rid of the sovereignty of all the countries. Now, how they're going to achieve that, it could be done in many different ways. And they have a handful of ways, certainly, that are planned. But it has to be something where the people are totally destroyed.
Well, give us an idea of what we should be looking out for.
Well, I personally think that, you know, we could be looking at a collapse of the world financial system, where everything just sort of goes up in flames. But I don't believe that that's going to be the case. We could also be looking at...
Why not?
Because they've used that sort of thing in the past. And I think that they're not going to repeat that. That's just my personal feeling. You know, obviously they're building it up. I mean, if you look at the debt throughout the world right now, there's so much debt we can never pay it back. So obviously it's going to collapse. But I think before that collapse comes, they're going to use some other type of crisis which really scares the people to the point of, you know, being scared to death. Meaning that, you know, we're looking at something like, you know, a biological weapon which would be used against the people of the world, where slowly, you know, thousands and thousands are dying off, and that is something that would really scare everyone. You know, and I think these things like the Ebola epidemics that they're part of, I see these as sort of test phases to see how will people react if something like that happens. Now, you could imagine if we had some type of a, you know, an AIDS virus, which was airborne, going from person to person, that would scare the people so much, they'd be willing to accept anything if there was a solution for that problem. The other possibility that I see is that we're looking at what we would consider a third world war. Only, in my opinion, a third world war is not going to be countries against countries as in the past. I would expect more a worldwide civil war, where inside of all the different countries, you have civil wars which break out among the polarized societies that we have. If you look over the past years, the media is really being used to polarize societies along different lines. You know, it's along racial lines, you know, black, white, Hispanic. It's along economic lines, rich against poor. It's along religious lines, you know, Christian, Muslim, Jew. This polarization is being done in all countries. And that is a potential powder keg, which at any time they can light the match and that can go off. Now, here in Europe, we have this this refugee crisis. That's a potential block. Now, I think with the refugees, it's very understandable why they come here. If you drop bombs on somebody's town, they usually take off. They don't stick around. Well, that's essentially what they've done here. So they knew they were going to create refugees. Then they can get them into Europe. And now that they're here, there's a very easy way to polarize society where the refugees don't feel comfortable because the citizens of the country, they seem to think like they're not wanted. The citizens of the countries are not happy because they have to pay for all of this, and they never really had a choice in it themselves. So we also have these, you know, this polarization here. I think we're seeing a lot of it in France right now, where they've had a lot of immigrants coming into the country, and France is no longer France.
One of the reasons that people are invited, they're invited when they're kind of up-and-coming politicians, up-and-coming maybe writers. And the idea is to sort of, we've seen, for example, Tony Blair and Bill Clinton just arrive here just before they became powerful. What is really going on in there?
Well, I think it's a vetting process. I think that they do invite people here to the meetings for certain purposes, but mainly I think it's a vetting situation where they put them to the test and see how people react. And often, I would say the majority of the people who get invited to this meeting only show up once, and they don't get invited back. Now, others who start getting invited back end up getting key roles. Now, one I would name at this meeting is this Ursula von der Leyen. She was there last year, and she's here again this year. Well, that means that they probably have higher expectations for her. So she would be one who would be a potential replacement for Angela Merkel, who's sort of lost her appeal among the citizens.
Your journey to finding out about Bilderberg really came through Iran-Contra. I mean, how does Iran-Contra lead here?
Well, it had to do with the fact that the Iran-Contra situation was something that the press really, they knew about it for a long time. There were reporters down there actually following what was going on right through 1985 and back, and they would not report about it. And later, when it finally came out, they did end up having to report about it. But then we had the situation where William Casey from the CIA was the fall guy who was given all of the blame for it, and unfortunately he died with an operation. And that was pretty much the end of it. And for me, that was a key moment where I lost trust in the system. I wanted to figure out why that was. And that's where I began my journey investigating people. And in the end, you end up with groups like this, you know, this Bilderberg group is one of the key groups. You know, it's a key roundtable group.
I mean, some people will say that, that actually that there's a, such a degree of manipulation that the Russians really, and the Chinese, you couldn't, you know, that they are part of the game. This is just one part of a much bigger game with the Chinese and the Russians in on the same thing. What do you make of that?
Well, that's my feeling. I actually think that all of these groups are played off against each other. And I don't think that there's really an opposition from the Russian side or from the Chinese side. If you take China, for example, they've been in on the game since 1973. You know, when Kissinger and Nixon came up with the idea to basically transfer Western industry over to China, use the slave population there to build, you know, goods cheaply, and then pay off the Chinese with the, you know, American treasury bills, which in the end are worthless. But now China owns quite a lot of treasury bills. So, you know, that was one way that to help destroy, you know, Western industry. And we have that today. That's, you know, also, you know, this, the slave factories. Apple is a very good example. They're building goods at slave wages, and that's one way to sort of keep an official inflation rate down when the real inflation rate is much higher. Yeah, because all of these goods that they're measuring the inflation rate with, this, you know, basket of commodities and things, you know, they contain things like iPhones or televisions or whatever. And from year to year, a slave gets the same wage. So you keep the inflation down.
I wonder maybe if that kind of slavery type system is moving to the West, because we see a lot of people now completely dependent, even though they're working full time, dependent on kind of in-work benefits, things like that in Britain. But I mean, I'm not going to let you off the hook on Russia, because are you telling us that what's been going on in Eastern Ukraine, Donbass, that's staged?
I personally believe it's staged. A lot of these color revolutions are what I would consider Western controlled. Money from the West comes in, they stir up some agitation to create a reaction. And this has been done, you know, for years and years in many different places. You know, I think Afghanistan was a good one, where the West funded Al-Qaeda in the beginning. They used the terrorists to go over the Soviet border, create terror attacks. The Soviets reacted to it, and that got the Afghanistan war going there back in 1980. And that was a big success. And that same situation is being used today even more. We saw it in Libya. It was the exact same thing. You send the terrorists in, they create problems, the country reacts, Gaddafi sent his troops as a reaction to that. Then in the press, it says, oh, Gaddafi's troops are, you know, committing terrible acts, we have to do something, and all of a sudden NATO is dropping bombs. And now we have Libya as a failed state. Then what happened? They took those same terrorists, they went off on vacation for a while, and then later, they show up over in Syria, and they do the same thing again. And I think probably, in the end, the last domino to fall there will be Iran. I expect a very similar thing to happen in Iran.
Well, you've been talking originally about these crises, that kind of thing, and that is, I think that's in a lot of people's mind here, covering Bilderberg, that there's some crisis heading our way, we're not quite sure what. What are your thoughts about how ordinary folk can do something about this?
Well, I think what's very important is that at this point, we really can't provide any opposition to what's going on. What we need to do is we need to inform people that a crisis will come. And when the crisis comes, we can't react the way they want us to react. And that's where I see the important thing is we need to get enough people informed so that they can explain it to others, that when the so-called crisis arrives, we can say, this is an artificial crisis here. It's not really a crisis. So don't react the way they want us to react.
But the rich and powerful are not going to allow a plan B, are they?
Well, that's right. But I think in the end, we're going to see some type of a revolution. And whether this revolution is successful or not, you know, that's really the question, because we're dealing now with the very first time that the world has ever seen a technological tyranny. In the past, we didn't have such a technological control over the people. But we have Big Brother now, we have the police state, and those are things that, you know, could you imagine if Hitler had that when he came to power? Things probably would have ended up differently. And that's, unfortunately, that's where we are right now.
Well, I mean, someone points out that IBM were helping the Nazis in the run-up to and during the Second World War in profiling people, categorizing them.
Yes, but the technology at that time was fairly limited compared to what it is today. That's true. I mean, Thomas Watson, it was very much involved with that. Only most people don't know that. It's also the same question of, you know, where did the funding come for Hitler? I always like, that's one of my questions I've always had, where I said, you had Germany, World War I, they were totally destroyed. Within 20 years, although they had to pay reparations and everything, they built the country back up, and all of a sudden they were a world power again. Money had to come from somewhere to finance that. And where did it come from? You don't get that in the school. There were court cases after World War II, which did show that there was funding coming from the West to fund Hitler. One of the examples was Union Bank. That was Prescott Bush days, there with the Harriman brothers. But that's just one example. I'm sure that there was a lot more than just that connection. But that's one that we know about because it was documented in actual court cases.
Yeah, for a lot of people, this is quite dark stuff. They don't really want to think about it. It's actually quite scary. Anything you can say to sort of burst that bubble?
Well, I think, unfortunately, look, we have the European Soccer Championships right now. The competition is beginning. So the people they would much rather spend their time watching that. Now, just look here. There's only a handful of people here in the end. You know, what is it, 50 or 100 who are here for what I would consider an important topic? And there's a few thousand in front of the big screens watching a bunch of grown men in shorts running around making fools out of themselves and getting paid millions for it.
You're depressing me even more now, but there must be some light at the end of the tunnel.
Right now, to think about the fact that we're alive, we're experiencing this, this is most likely the most interesting time to have ever been alive. We're about to experience one of the most important conflicts that the world has ever seen. And it's really a question, will tyranny eliminate freedom, or will freedom reign over tyranny? That's the question, and we don't know how it's going to end.
Rich Nyland there, and I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago at the Bilderberg Conference, and that was in Dresden in Germany. The Bilderberg consists of about 130 of the most powerful people in the NATO countries. And some say it's a New World Order plot to take over the world. Interesting to see what Rich Nyland made of that. That's all for this week. Dial X Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast, and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to this week's guests, Rachel Brody. Also to the Grassy Knoll shooter, James Files, still in a US jail. Also to Rich Nyland, interested in the New World Order, biological weapons or financial collapse, what's it to be? Also, to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.